This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
We're going to try to get and, you know, make sense then of this government of national unity. Call it what you want, a grand coalition. Call it coalition if you want as well. Whatever you want to, you know, it's been made fair to us to pronounce as it is. Of course, government is going with the terminology of government of national unity. And as you would have heard today from, of course, the Gauteng perspective, the government of national unity conceptualized by the ANC, and we invited other political parties into it. You know, my stance on it is the one where I say, well, in essence, you had to come up with the concept, whether it be coalition, government of national unity, coalition government, or, you know, working arrangement. You had to, because on the one instance, you're on 40%, and then the other instance here in Gauteng, where we are, it's on 36% of the issue. So let's bring Dr. Saisman Motlohong into the conversation, just to begin to have an understanding then of where we are. Dr. Saisman Motlohong, welcome to Power 98.7. Welcome to Power Perspective. How are you?
I'm good, and you, Denzel, and greetings to your listeners.
I'm really, really good. Let me start with you, Doctor, and ask you, you know, people talk about all the aspects of the announcements and where they are and what positions they occupy and whether good or bad and finance. You know, I heard a lot of people saying, finance, lucky, it stayed the same, there's continuity there. So people talk about a lot of those particular things when they engage an aspect of this particular nature. One of the other things they do engage to is this particular term that says market friendly. Let's start there in essence. Market friendly, what is market friendly and what is not market friendly? Would the one coalition be market friendly and would the other coalition be, you know, not have been market friendly? You know, just give me an aspect of that terminology, market friendly. I think I know what it really, really means, but maybe there's something I'm missing about, you know, who's good for market friendliness and who's really bad for market friendliness, Doc?
Yeah, I think it's mainly a policy direction. If there is a significant shift to policies that disrupt your normal business operation, the security of property, and here property could mean land, could mean physical buildings. The policy of nationalization and expropriation are things that are typically not market friendly. These are your more socialist policies.
Yeah.
And I think more of a state intervention in the market itself, if the state were to extend its influence in setting prices or more protectionist policies, those would be seen as not market friendly. And anything that allows your free market and allow individuals leeway to dictate their business operations and strategies will be seen as more conducive to the market.
So, Doc, then I would suggest then that markets being business, business being the economy, and I would suggest then when one speaks of market friendly and who's market friendly, that in essence, you know, a deal of this particular nature would have been written, you know, and agreed upon just by virtue of business suggesting what market friendly is and what's not market friendly. So a lot of it, you use the word leeway to dictate. I suppose business would have dictated a lot of these terms before business even opened its mouth about what the terminology would be. But business was a huge factor in this regard anyway, even though they were not sitting at the table.
Yeah, and it takes us back to the political party funding. This is one aspect of it. When the NGO sector was saying, let us know who is funding these political parties, the idea was about transparency for them or the public to know or determine if a party A is in government or controlling power, and where does it allocate government contracts. If these contracts go to people who are majority donors to a political party, this would be seen as a symptom of corruption. But we have not really taken thought of those funders, maybe in the background as a, call it lobbying these political parties to say, as you now formulate the government under a coalition, or like you have said, government is framing it as a government of national unity, to what extent have these donors been whispering in the ears of the political parties? So, hey, remember, we supported you. Are they actually doing it? Or is it something that is an obligation? You know, if I've been sponsoring you, then the next thing, when you win a trophy, you want to come show me. You know, you have that moral duty.
Absolutely.
So I think we have to think, to what extent are these political parties themselves feeling morally obliged to ensure that the policies that prevail are friendly to their donors, in a sense. So we now have to accept that as much as we talk about the market as the economy, private businesses, and so forth, we have to now look at the political market itself, where ideologies clash. And there is no longer a possibility for a free political market, a free thought. It is now corporatized, whereby the ideas that have a more muscle and financial backing seems to prevail, and those that are anti-establishment and those that are opposing the other view, even though they are prevailing, even though they are dictating, if in the language of that invisible hand, if the socialist policies find support and favor in society, they are also thwarted by this threat that if these policies were to prevail, they will harm your private sector.
Sure.
And this is essentially, if we were to talk about democracy, this is what it should be. If the season of capitalist policies is over, then naturally you should allow that process to happen. But it seems as if there are those that are threatening that you should not follow this natural process. You have to now engineer a status quo where the sustainability of capitalist policies has to prevail, even if it is no longer conducive for them.
Sure. And I would dare to suggest and almost with certainty suggest, Doc, that those same people who are, you know, whispering into, you know, opposition political parties and saying this is what you need to go fight for and or go and demand these particular aspects, they would be the same ones also who would be talking to a ruling party, for example, and saying, we think this is the best route for you to take, you know, because 1, 2, and 3 could be, you know, the answer to your questions if you go this particular route. I suppose, you know, what's good for the goose is also good for the gander in aspect of these talks that happen.
That could be likely. And now if you stretch it further, you'd say those that are in the governing party have become the establishment themselves, because if you look at your president, how he is close to the captains of industry himself as a wealthy person, some political parties or political leaders themselves own land. And if you were to allow the policy of expropriation or a policy that says government should own all land, they will be harming themselves. Then you now expect that they will oppose such policies to protect their vested interests. And this brings us to a concept that is also being popular in the U.S. as you look at how Donald Trump and Biden are contesting for power, the concept of plutocracy, where people that are in the rich, the wealthy rich people, are vying for power. The discontent in America is, why do we have these old people? And in a country that is over 300 million, aren't there younger people, aren't there innovative ideas in political leadership? So the Americans also see the wealthy people in the establishment also standing in to be in control of power, to protect service gatekeepers themselves. So you could look at the governing power, the governing party here in South Africa, being part of those that have a vested interest in ensuring that you don't have a big disruption of the status quo.
Let's get to some of the detail then of this GNU that we saw in front of us, Doc. John Steenhuisen is in it. Willem-Kosini, Tlabisa is in it. Mackenzie is in it. Groenewald is in it. Nyonzo is in it. De Lille is in it. Bantu Olomisa, part of the, you know, deputy ministers are all in it. It you know, in as much as I see all of them there holding positions of you know, ministerial and in cabinet, it raises a lot of questions for me that are not being raised in the media and or by analysts in essence. And maybe you can speak to that, because what one understands from cabinet and what a lot of people were arguing about is it is the prerogative of the president. It is the prerogative of the president. And government would come on board and say it is the prerogative of the president. Remember that these are negotiations, but it is still the prerogative of the president. When you see the leaders as they are heading a political party, in essence, and not necessarily being the best in that particular portfolio, merely by being the leader of a political party does not make you good at education, good at land, good at, you know, sport, good at this. It says to me it wasn't quite the prerogative of the president, because either there was a decision made to include or inclusive of all the political leadership on the one side from Cyril Ramaphosa to say, I will then choose each one of you that comes as a political party, not necessarily on your strength, as I've just pointed out that, you know, they would not necessarily be the best ones in those particular portfolios. But also then, on the issue of prerogative then, where that's concerned, they could have put other people forward, but they didn't. So either these political parties, by choice, put themselves forward to the president as we are the best in our departments, in our political parties, for you to choose from, or it wasn't the president's prerogative in the first place as they presented themselves to him. So it nullifies the term prerogative that was quite put to us in essence.
Yeah, I think the optics of it, when the so-called leaks were happening from the DA and responses from the ANC and a stern tone from President Ramaphosa to say, it is my prerogative to choose. I was also thinking, could this have been also deliberate somehow to present as if there's the robust negotiation.
Yeah, and that they were in control of the process, and that he was, you know, they were not losing any power in essence.
Yes, but then when the decision happens, you could see that what the DA demanded, it got, even though it was not numerically so, but more of their interested portfolios they got. And was this the president's prerogative, as you're saying? It would be doubted, really. You are clear to understand that the president was giving in to these demands. And in giving in to them, it now nullifies that logic if this was the president's prerogative. Then, to his defense, one would say, yeah, but this is a unique circumstance. It's under a negotiated settlement. Therefore, it is not as such a nullification of that principle, because eventually it is the president who will announce and say, I nominate, and therefore will fulfill that principle of a president nominating. And then to come to an aspect of political parties presenting themselves and political leaders in those parties, saying, you'll choose me as Steenhuisen, and the aspect of capacity, is he the best suited person for that portfolio?
Yeah.
I think we would also accept it from our culture of a political party list, whereby from these political parties, it is understood that a certain people are at the top, at the helm, even though they have been, it's a list for the legislature. But there is that seniority, it seems, within these political parties. And it seems the political parties themselves have come to an understanding, to agree that in this process of negotiation, you will be representing us as a party. I don't think they imposed themselves, but it was as a foregone issue to say, you are senior people in the party. It would make sense if you become ministers to remain visible to the public. Otherwise, Steenhuisen would remain as a leader of the party and member of parliament, while somebody else, the minister, maybe they enjoy more political mileage. It will be self-defeating in a sense. So I think these were considerations in the post.
Which then speaks to a flaw in essence and a flaw in the system, Doctor, that says, We were not choosing from those best foot forward. We were making a political decision around political parties, around a political settlement, rather than he who is best suited. Because I could think of, a thousand people maybe better than John Steenhuisen in the DA that would suit agriculture. I could think of, a thousand people better, in the Freedom Front Plus baby than Pieter Groenewald that would suit his particular portfolio, or Gayton and Kenzie for sport and art, But it seemed as though a political, settlement was reached or decision was leaned towards, rather than choose from those whose best foot forward, in essence, would have made sense.
Yeah, I think this would be a case of our politics. Even when ANC was governing alone, the public has been responding negatively to some portfolios, especially looking into the police ministry, would say, why don't you put in a career police person there? And then I think Ria Piecha was one of them, but Marikana happened. Even though a career police person was there at the helm. And to come to say a minister who is a medical practitioner would be best suited to guide health and there wouldn't be corruption, I think is to romanticize.
Yeah, it's to be naive,
Yeah, and we I think this is what we really come to terms with. And it will be political leaders who are really idealist to come and say, I'm at the helm, but I'm not capacitated enough, and I will deploy somebody who's more best placed. And that is very rare to happen. I don't think it even happens the same way anywhere in the world.
What do you think, Doctor? Do you think the ANC, the president in essence, has been able to balance the different forces in the ANC in what he has particularly put forward here? That whole persuasion, or to may not look and make it feel as though it is a reflection of an ANC DA grand coalition. And so, the IFPPA, Freedom Front Plus, PAC Good, and Bantu Olomisa and all the others are included. And everybody speaks of it as, it's an all-inclusive aspect of it. But I suppose also what the ANC needed to do here was to, because if one looks and speaks to people on the ground, sometimes senior people, sometimes people in the region, sometimes part of the tri alliance and all of these other groupings, not many are really happy with that. Do you think there's been an effort to balance the different forces in the ANC here, to hold them together? And my next question will be based on how you answer this one, of course.
and I think as you're talking, I'm thinking from the outside, even outside the country, anyone who's in Africa, anywhere in the world, looking at this kind of an outcome, this is impressive. This is really laudable to even have a government of national unity composed like this, where there hasn't even been violence. I think this is laudable anywhere in the world. And you are also talking to the dynamics of your inter-party contestation. I think how the President Ramaphosa worked it through also shows his strength and the favor he enjoys also in the party. It seems that he's a person who's in control of that NEC, in control of that political party. And how he came to decide and in balancing this, as you say, also consider he's not somebody who's also arrogant or who undermines, underestimates the forces within the party, the opposition, the opposing factions within the party itself. So you could see with the a combination that he brought, he brought in those faces that enjoy support. If you are to talk with the young guys, the young people would be okay, and the old guys are also there, and those trusted and tested comrades in the ANC, he brought them through. To some extent, it's disappointing in my view that it's a cabinet from the ANC side that is more about reshuffling, still retaining the old people. So those old faces, I think, ensure there is still stability in the ANC. He really did not shift the scales in the political party itself. He navigated a stable outcome, I think. Even though there are those who are disgruntled, it will be in the corners or in those private meetings. But no one,
those WhatsApp groups.
No one in public will stand and denigrate him or start a campaign of sort against Ramaphosa himself. So I think he tried to play that. And how he decoupled some of the departments to allow room for other people in deputy ministerials and so forth. I think he did the best that he can, considering that his political party was really wounded after this election. And it is something I think he's been at pains at, maybe explaining to say, we have to make best of what we have. And I think anyone who's realistic in the ANC also has to accept what happens, that you are not in that commanding position anymore. So if Mutong has to fall, let him fall, and the better preferred leaders to be put in cabinet. And the politics are not only about cabinet. We still have parliament, and you'll realize that many of these people are still in parliament, and it will be, I think that is another consolation. The debates where those, I think, tired leftist, or rather pseudo-radical tones that are saying, you have betrayed the struggle, you have betrayed, you know, by selling out to this white party or colonial descendants. I don't think those kind of politics are still resonating well with us, with our electorate. So this is more of a moderate political climate, a policy-driven climate, and it is interesting to see how a government of national unity would come up with a program of action, a more detailed action plan as well, more than that statement of intent that we've seen.
Sure. Doc, bloated cabinets. I'm not sure that I've seen anyone, you know, as bloated as this, and people would have been at, you know, the president's throat, you know, had the circumstances been very, very different. I mean, there's 32 ministers up from 30 ministers. There's 42 deputy ministers from 36 ministers. A massive, massive bloated cabinet. I can give you the costs as well. Collectively, you know, 1 billion rand estimated, over 1 billion rand estimated in annual benefits and perks to those particular ministers. And you know, a number of 183 million rand in salaries that would be spent also annually on this particular system. So, you know, quite an expensive system that we're going to have to be engaging in for the next 5 years at least. And if Government of National Unity is going to be the way now that we proceed, then that's going to be the costing of it. So would it be a conversation, this bloated, you know, cabinet that somewhat is... he is forgiven, or the ANC is forgiven for, because of the realization that it is a government of national unity. Why have we not been stricter on the essence of a bloated government? Why have we been so, you know, so acceptable in essence of a bloated system that's going to cost the fiscus so much money, when in essence what's being actually done here is to accommodate, you know, parties differently and all of that. I would have thought, you know, even when you do a government of national unity and you are accommodating, that the aspect of the economy, that the aspect of you know, saving where you can in an economy where we've been growing at 1% over the last couple of years, in essence is where we, where what our past has been. Why have we been so forgiving on the bloated element? You know, is it because we see the necessity of this government of national unity, and we see, you know, maybe the downsides to it if it's not this?
Yeah, I think one of the aspects about President Cyril Ramaphosa is this willingness to accommodate. I think when it's like a plastic on a hot surface, he's willing to stretch himself even to a point where it's really unnecessary. You are correct, because he had made a commitment to repurpose ministries, and I was expecting this era it will be when he really makes true of that, and his willingness to accommodate was to let go of that understanding, and to even, like I'm saying, you also now given the details of it and the cost of it, to decouple ministries, to create, instead of taking the hit or that punch on the chin and say our party lost, and go to his comrades and say, this is the pain that we're going to endure for now. We're not creating any more ministries. If we're to come out of this with 14 ministries or 10 ministers, let it be.
Yeah.
We're not going to extend. So that is a criticism against him. He does not want to face the hard truth. He does not want to show a serious face to and stand against the storm. It is somebody, I think, most who criticize him for that. So what he did here was ensure that the party doesn't lose a lot from it. So he compensated for it. And a critical voter would look at this, and I think they will now consider the implication, cost implications to it. But we cannot do anything much as electorate. We have now delegated all decision-making to these representatives. It is something that I think South Africans would be yearning for, that leader who would stomp his foot and say, no, draw the line and nothing else from here.
Yeah.
So that is really unfortunate. And I think conceptually, those who are in organizational design, organizational theories, we talk about building in a redundancy into a system. Whenever an organization is really faltering, you have to build in these parallel structures, and you do so to avoid disruptions in the system. And I think this is what he did. As we're talking about how he may have handled his relationship with his political party, I think this was his way of avoiding disruptions within the political party. This was not anything about national interests. This was not anything about a policy, a priorities. He cannot say, I put so many there and there because I have this kind of a, as a coalition, as a national unity government, we have these priorities, and this is why that minister and that deputy should be two in that ministry. Mm. He cannot rationalize for that, except in what we are speculating. It was only for political expediency.
Yeah, because in essence, where the ANC would have lost a lot of portfolios, he just went and created more portfolios so that they could all be accommodated in. It's like it's like when you run out of money, you just print money. He, in essence, just printed money in this particular essence. Doc, before I let you go, Doc, anything that stands out for you in the you know, significant in the ministerial, you know, deployment of anything? You know, was it agriculture? Was it land reform? Was it education? You know, was it international? Was it home affairs? Anything that just stood out for you and said, "Oh, wow, that's surprising."
I think for me, it was the constitutional ministry and your correctional services, how they split them. It was something I've not thought of, because there was some A interaction between the two ministries and the tensions between how the members are treated in the correctional facilities and how the minister also works in on issues of parole where sometimes I thought it would make sense if these ministries were to be together. And I was not really expecting Lamola himself to be deployed to DECO, but I do understand how he was put up there to head the ministry. I think over the last 5 years, he has really garnered some international significance. Mm. So it was something interesting for me, and I was thinking in higher education. I think at want to put it out there. I think Buti Manamela's time should be now. I don't understand how he would still be kept as a deputy minister.
Mm.
Really, really, I don't understand that. It is something I'm really still battling with. I do some research also in water, so I was also not happy when I see that Minister Mkunu is also removed there, because I think as he came, he restored some confidence and trust in that ministry after Memkonyane, you know, and some of the projects were really working, and we could see some institutional realignments that are happening in the department, and how Rendota is beginning to also be seen visible in infrastructure projects. I thought he did very well, and I wished he could stay longer in that ministry.
Dr. Seisman Motlohong, thank you so much for joining me here on Power Perspective tonight. It's been a pleasure, sir. And as developments, of course, happen, we'll be engaging again, and we'll be asking again the tough questions to you. And hopefully you'll always have, you know, the tough answers for us. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Kipwell.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Seisman Motlohong talking to us there.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.